We gather to celebrate George Yen, who is the inaugural Edwin S. Cohen Distinguished Professor of Taxation. And let me welcome Mary Walter, George's wife, who is with us today. Let me also point out, though it's not very visible yet, there will a reception will materialize to your left, my right, at the end of George's remarks, and we encourage you to stay for that event. The chair's name for Edwin S. Cohen, class of 1936, member of the faculty of the law school from 1964 to 1985, save for 4 years when he was Undersecretary of the Treasury, in which position he had a significant role in passage of some major tax reform legislation. Class of 1936, he continued to teach a tax seminar here until the year 2004, and died last year at the age of 91. The Edwin S. Cohen Distinguished Professor of Law and Taxation, which is the position that George now holds, was created by generous contributions from Eddie Cohen and from his son, Edwin C. Cohen, also a graduate of the law school, class of 1967, as well as by contributions from Eddie's former students. Currently, the chair has an endowment of a little north of $1.6 million. Eddie Cohen was a brilliant tax lawyer and a dedicated teacher, and a man who, both as a lawyer and a citizen, cared deeply about the fairness and the efficacy of the tax system. These qualities and these concerns are fully shared by George Yen, and so it is particularly fitting that he should be the first holder of Eddie's chair. George graduated, took his BA from the University of Michigan in 1970. After 2 years in the teacher corps, he received a master's degree in early childhood education from the University of Florida, managed a daycare center, worked as a computer programmer, in 1974 entered law school at George Washington University, from which he received his JD in 1977. George, your subsequent career shows the kind of type A achievement that one might expect of a law school faculty member, but I think your early work puts you pretty much in a class by yourself. We have some talented people on this faculty, but I'm not sure there are many of your colleagues who could conceivably be imagined or tolerated running a daycare center. After law school, George clerked on the U.S. Court of Claims and then worked for Sutherland, Aspel, and Brennan in D.C. He became in 1983 the Majority Tax Counsel for the Senate Finance Committee under the chairmanship of Bob Dole, worked closely with Senator Dole on a number of projects, in particular the reform and simplification of corporate tax laws. In 1986, George left the government to enter teaching at the University of Florida, from which he was enticed to come here in 1994. From the moment George walked in the doors of these buildings, he distinguished himself as a superb teacher. Put simply, his students love him. I could say much more on that subject, but let me quote one student comment, which in its warmth and typicality, and also in its content, will serve for many. I never imagined I would find a tax course so engaging. Bet you haven't heard that before. Professor Yen is funny and very clear to the point that I actually understood what he was talking about. Many of us would feel blessed and surprised to hear those comments said about us. Perhaps that's the residual benefit of the early childhood business. In 2003, George left us for what turned out to be a little over 2 years as Chief of Staff of the Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation, which is one of the most influential tax positions in the country. The Joint Committee is composed of the five senior members of the Senate Finance Committee and the five senior members of the House Ways and Means Committee. I guess I should say them in the reverse order, since the House has priority in matters of tax. The Joint Committee has an expert and nonpartisan staff of lawyers and economists who work with members of Congress and their aides on every aspect of the tax legislative process, from developing tax proposals to analyzing the economic impact of new legislation to the oversight of the administration of the existing tax laws. For George, these duties included drafting and reviewing several major pieces of legislation and testifying before committees on other matters, ranging from plans to improve tax collection to various schemes that might employ the tax code in an effort to revive the Gulf Coast economy after Hurricane Katrina. I think it's fair to say that George's current intellectual agenda in part reflects the experience he had as Chief of Staff of the Joint Committee. He's very interested in the process by which tax legislation is enacted and interested in the impact that such legislation has on economic activity generally and in particular on business enterprises. Unlike some in his profession, George believes that the structure of taxation should vary with the type, or perhaps more accurately, with the scale, the complexity of business enterprises. That is to say that he does not favor, as some do, strict entity taxation, but approves, at least in some contexts, conduit taxation, which is the format for partnership. Currently writing with Professor Karen Burke, a course book on taxation of business enterprises, which I take it will cover the corporate and partnership and other structures of business activity. And these, as in all matters, George is distinguished by sane and balanced judgment. These qualities of mind and of personality, coupled with encyclopedic knowledge of the tax law and a deep understanding of the way in which tax law is made, makes George one of the most respected scholars of tax law and policy. I want to underline those last two words, tax law and policy. They are essential to understanding George's scholarship and his citizenship. So much of tax practice, at least, and some of the tax scholarship, deals with ways of minimizing the taxation burdens on individuals or corporations. George focuses instead on ways to improve the tax system to make it both more effective and more equitable. And as we will hear today, his current research expands his focus to the legislative process more generally, specifically to the procedures that would lead Congress to accept greater fiscal responsibility for the legislation it enacts. Finally, I should mention one of George's current projects that's near to my heart, and perhaps to one or two of yours. There's a tax code section that allows students, that is some students, to exclude from income the discharged amount of educational loans. Those of you familiar with the loan forgiveness program will understand why this might be of interest to you, because the discharged amount of loans, absent special legislation, would be included in income. The tax court has said, reading the statute as if its words were controlling, that the provision allowing for the exclusion of loan forgiveness applies to medicine, nursing, and teaching, but not law. And George has helped us to approach that. The IRS is now apparently prepared to issue a clarifying ruling that will allow law school graduates as eligible for, I know, George, this is technically maladroit, but eligible for tax-free loan forgiveness, if I can call it that. When George went to Washington for a couple of years to be the Chief of Staff of the Joint Committee, that was a great honor to him. It's one of the most important tax positions in the country. And it also is a great service to the country. That is a difficult assignment, a demanding one, and one of great importance in the actual definition and implementation of public policy. But, George, we miss you, and we are very glad to have you back, and very glad that you will assume what we hope you will regard as the great honor of being the inaugural Edwin S. Cohen Distinguished Professor of Law and Taxation. George Yen.
Thank you so much. Can you hear me? Is this mic working fine? Good. Thank you. Thank you all so much, Dean Jeffries. That was a delightful and very generous introduction. And distinguished colleagues, students, family, and friends, thank you all for coming. It truly is a special honor to be here today as to speak with you as the first recipient of the Edwin S. Cohen Chair. As John related, Ed is deservedly remembered for his many achievements as a teacher and scholar, as a public servant, as a distinguished member of the private bar. But my memories of Ed center around more personal times where I got to know him and got to appreciate the strength of his character, the power of his intellect, his very endearing personality, and of course his wonderful sense of humor. It was really a privilege to get to know Ed and Helen and to have them as friends. And as the first holder of his chair, I will certainly endeavor to try to live up to his very high standard. Should the United States enact more temporary laws, most observers would probably answer that question in the negative, after taking into account the need for stability and predictability. They might see a role for temporary legislation if the policy outcome were particularly controversial or uncertain. A recent possible example of that would be something like the Patriot Act. But these cases would clearly be exceptions, I think, to most observers. In my talk today, I'm going to take the opposite position and argue in favor of more temporary laws, for at least the broad swath of federal legislation dealing with taxes and spending. My principal reason is fiscal responsibility, which is a view directly at odds with the position of many critics of the recent passage of temporary tax cuts. But I will also briefly touch upon a few other policy reasons why temporary legislation, or its close cousin, temporary effect legislation, which I define as laws whose budget effect is of only a limited duration, may not be as troubling as first feared. My talk is organized as follows. First, I will provide a little bit of background about the congressional process of approving tax and spending legislation. Understanding this background is key to appreciating my central thesis that the enactment of temporary effect legislation, but not permanent legislation, facilitates fiscal responsibility. I will explain my thesis principally through an example involving two familiar federal programs. Finally, I will discuss a few non-budget related issues concerning this choice of a law's duration. When the Congress decides which federal programs to support in a given year, it faces a task not unlike the one children encounter when they walk into their favorite candy store. So many choices, so little time and money. Most spending programs are approved on an annual basis, which means that the decision-making process essentially repeats itself year after year. An important class of spending programs, however, generally referred to as entitlement programs, is approved on a permanent basis. Of course, nothing is truly permanent in life or in Washington. Any law can be subsequently modified or repealed by Congress, including a law establishing a permanent entitlement program. But unless and until that happens, the law continues in effect, and people who are eligible continue to receive the law's benefits. In that sense, the difference between permanent and temporary effect legislation is simply the default rule applicable to the law's duration. Permanent legislation continues in effect until changed or terminated by congressional action, whereas temporary effect legislation expires unless extended by such action. Up until recently, almost all tax programs were also approved on a permanent basis. An example would be the home mortgage interest deduction, presumably approved by Congress to encourage and subsidize home ownership. Because the deduction is permanent, unless the law is changed, you will be entitled to deduct the interest on your future home mortgages. For over 30 years, budget law has required Congress to keep track of the cost of new spending and tax programs each year. The purpose is not exactly the same as household budgeting, because Congress, of course, has budgetary options not available to most households. Congress can, for example, borrow to pay for the cost of a new program and pass on that IOU to future generations of Americans. Instead, the budget law requirement is intended to accomplish at least two other things. First, it potentially enables Congress to make smarter decisions. Is this piece of candy really worth twice as much as some other item that it could acquire at that time? And second, it allows the public to scrutinize what Congress has done to make sure that the legislature's priorities are consistent with its own. The cost of proposed new spending and tax programs is the difference between the amount of government revenues or outlays that would occur with the program and the amount that would occur without the program. The latter amount is known as the baseline. It is determined by overlaying onto current law the economic and other variables that are projected to occur over the budget period under consideration. Thus, for example, the baseline cost of a tax program, such as the credit for research and development expenditures, the R&D credit, is determined by applying the terms of current law to estimates of the expected amount and timing of expenditures qualifying for the credit, the tax situations of the taxpayers eligible to claim the credit, the likely participation rates of those taxpayers in the program, and a number of other factors. In addition, baseline estimates are of current law, which includes scheduled changes in the law. Baseline estimates, therefore, generally assume that expirations of temporary laws will take place as scheduled. The estimation process is then repeated, but under the assumption that current law is modified by the new legislation being considered. The repeat process does not simply apply the terms of the modified law to the same assumptions that are incorporated into the baseline. Rather, the estimated budget consequences of the law as modified takes into account the anticipated microeconomic behavioral responses to the modification. For example, if the proposed change in the law is to double the rate of the R&D credit, the estimator might anticipate a higher participation rate than is used in the baseline, an increase in the amount of qualifying expenditures, and other changes. The difference between the budget consequence of the law with and without the proposed modification is the cost or revenue estimate of the proposal. The estimates are presented as specific dollar figures for each of a finite number of fiscal years into the future, termed the budget window. In general, the budget window has consisted of 10 fiscal years. The estimates represent the expected cash flow changes to the government, that is, the changed number of dollars expected to flow either into or out of the government during a particular fiscal year as a result of the legislation being considered. With this little background, let me now try to explain why increased use of temporary effect legislation, but not permanent legislation, facilitates greater fiscal responsibility. The budget law typically places some type of restraint on Congress regarding the total amount that may be spent during any particular budget window period. For example, some of you may be aware of the revival of the pay-as-you-go or PAYGO rule in the current Congress, which in effect provides that the net 10-year cost of certain programs approved by Congress may not be positive. In other words, if Congress were to pass, say, a tax cut this year, thereby reducing the amount of taxes someone would otherwise have to pay, Congress would be forced to pass a tax increase on somebody else or a law reducing government spending in order to offset the cost of the tax cut. Importantly, all of these costs are determined only for the budget window period, typically 10 years. It's natural, therefore, to focus on whether legislative practices and budget accounting rules result in an accurate measurement of costs within the window period. Supporters of legislation have long used various techniques to try to reduce the cost of legislation within the window period. One technique is to delay the starting effect of legislation until late in the window period, or gradually phase in that effect. Because this technique has the potential disadvantage of delaying the realization of benefits produced by the legislation, lawmakers sometimes employ an alternate technique of allowing the legislation to be immediately effective, but then terminating or sunsetting its effect prior to the end of the window period. By using either or both of these two techniques, supporters can reduce the estimated cost of legislation to just a fraction of what it would be estimated to cost had the legislation been in effect throughout the budget window period. Now, I have a handout, and if anyone needs a copy, I have some additional copies up here. If you would raise your hand if you need a copy. But if you all have one, if I could direct your attention to table one of the handout to illustrate the various techniques to reduce the 10-year official cost of proposed legislation. As you see in table one, I've imagined a program, it could be a tax program, it could be a spending program, that is projected to cost about $40 billion each fiscal year for a full 10-year cost of $400 billion, and that's what line one reflects. Now, supporters of that bill might be intimidated by the size of that $400 billion figure because, for example, under current rules, they would have to find some offset to essentially net that amount down to zero, and that might include a tax increase of somebody else estimated to raise $400 billion or a spending cut of some sort to reduce spending by $400 billion. In either event, that's obviously a very difficult thing to do as a political matter, and therefore supporters devise various ways to try to reduce the amount that they must offset. And I've listed in lines 2 through 5 four different ways, all of which have been done at various times in various ways. The second one is simply a gradual phase-in, where you notice that in fiscal year one, the program will only be a fraction of what its full program would be, and that's why the estimated cost is only $4 billion in the first year rather than 40. Gradually, it's phased in so that by year 10, you notice that the program is fully phased in. The cost in year 10 is therefore $40 billion. You notice that the sum total amount on line 2 is just slightly over one half of the full 10-year effect, and so you've now reduced the goal, if you will, or the political pain of having to offset this amount. Line 3 shows an alternative way where the effect of the program is simply delayed until year 6, and therefore in years 1 through 5 there is no cost. Year 6 is fully put into effect, and so then you see that the total cost now for the 10 years is only $200 billion. One of the problems, as I indicated with both the technique in line 2 and line 3, is that in terms of people who like this legislation and who are supporting the legislation or presumably going to benefit from the legislation, they're not too happy with the legislators because they look at both line 2 and line 3 and they say, gee, in the first few years there's hardly any program at all, right? And so an alternative technique which has been adopted and used is line 4, which is in year 1, you fully put the program immediately into effect, $40 billion right out of the box. But then you sunset that program at the end of year 5, so that now in years 6 through 10 there's no cost. And again, the total amount is only $200 billion. Finally, in line 5, I've just put a variety of these techniques together. In line 5, I've assumed both a delayed effective age until year 4, a phase-in so that in year 4 there's only a fraction of the cost. It's fully phased in by year 7, so there's a $40 billion cost in year 7, and then it's sunset, and therefore there's no cost in 8, 9, and 10. And as you can see, the sum of those figures turns out to be only $80 billion, or just one-fifth of the full 10-year cost. Okay? Well, as I say, all of these techniques have been used, and the goal has been to reduce this so-called official 10-year cost. Although these techniques have been used for a number of years, the extent and frequency of their use in the tax area grew dramatically beginning in 2001. In that year, Congress approved major tax cut legislation, virtually all of whose provisions expired 9 months prior to the end of the budget window period. In addition, it phased in or delayed the effect of many of the provisions. These two steps significantly reduced the estimated total cost of the legislation over the budget window. A good example is the repeal of the estate tax, which was included as part of the 2001 legislation. Due to the very gradual phase-in of the repeal and the sunset of the repeal as of December 31, 2010, the provision was estimated to cost about $138 billion over the 10-year budget window, or roughly one-fifth of the estimated cost had the repeal been in effect throughout the program. So you can think of what they did with the estate tax as illustrated by line 5, my combined techniques. Much of the same thing occurred in 2003 when Congress passed another major tax cut. In that year, the President proposed some important tax law revisions, including a change in the taxation of dividend income, which were estimated to cost over $700 billion during the applicable 10-year budget period. Congressional consideration of the President's proposal, however, resulted in an agreement to pass tax cuts costing no more than $350 billion over 10 years, or about half of what the President had proposed to spend. Instead of simply leaving out about half of the President's proposals, or making the tax cuts roughly half as deep, what Congress did instead was it turned to delayed effective dates, phase-ins, and sunsets to pass virtually the entire program while still complying with the tighter budgetary constraint. These practices have been sharply criticized by many analysts. The basic thrust of the criticism is that the practices enabled the Bush administration and congressional supporters to hide the true budgetary costs of the policy changes, and thereby to avoid the constraints imposed by the budget rules. As one observer stated in describing the, quote, Enron-style accounting, close quote, which caused the, quote, official budget projections to be universally seen as unreliable and even fraudulent, the 2003 bill's tax true cost will be close to double its official cost, close quote. To these critics, what was done was like replacing $5 price tags in that candy store with $2 ones, thereby allowing a child to buy more candy no matter what the budget constraint. To prevent these misrepresentations, some have suggested barring the practice of phasing in or sunsetting legislation in certain circumstances, or estimating the cost of legislation with such features as if the legislation were in effect throughout the budget window period. Another idea is to impose a 60-vote requirement in the Senate before certain temporary tax cuts could be agreed upon. Critics are surely correct that the motivation behind many of the delayed effective dates, phase-ins, and sunsets of recent tax legislation has been a desire to shrink the cost of legislation that has been taken into account for budget purposes. Since budget rules provide consequences that depend upon the official cost of legislation, political advantage can be gained by manipulating this amount. For the same reason, as we have seen, opponents of the legislation have generally focused on the same amount. But from the broader perspective of promoting greater fiscal responsibility, which is the goal of congressional budget rules, both proponents and opponents of the recent legislation have overlooked the real budgetary impact of the legislative practices. The budget process should provide a mechanism that conveys to lawmakers the true cost of their legislative activity before they act. As I've said, this information not only enables lawmakers to make more informed decisions, but also permits the public to hold lawmakers accountable for their choices. But the true cost of legislation is not necessarily its official cost. Rather, the true cost includes the budgetary consequences of the legislation throughout the period the legislation remains in effect. If that period extends beyond the end of the budget window period, then some of the true cost will not be accounted for at all in the budget process. Lawmakers will never have to face this cost and address whatever political or other ramifications arise from it. In contrast, if the effect of legislation does not extend beyond the end of the budget window period, then, barring estimation error, the true cost of the legislation is the official cost and is fully taken into account in the budget process. Lawmakers who pass such legislation do so only after internalizing fully the budgetary consequences of the legislation. These observations mean that, at least from the standpoint of promoting fiscal responsibility, legislation whose effect extends beyond the end of the budget window period, such as permanent legislation, should generally be disfavored, whereas legislation whose effect ends no later than the end of the budget period should generally be favored. An example comparing the repeal of the estate tax with the enactment of the Medicare prescription drug legislation illustrates this principle. As noted, repeal of the estate tax was included as part of the 2001 Tax Act and explicitly made a temporary measure. The law very gradually phased out the tax over the budget window period until 2010, when it completely repealed the tax. The law then revived the tax and returned it to its pre-2001 state beginning on January 1, 2011. The very slow phase-out of the tax, as well as the sunset of full repeal on December 31, 2010, or 9 months prior to the end of the budget window period, resulted in a significant reduction in the official 10-year cost of the change. Critics have pointed to this change, including its early sunset, as one of the most egregious enacted in recent years. Enactment of the Medicare prescription drug legislation in 2003 also presented budget issues. Early on, the president and congressional supporters agreed that this legislative effort should cost no more than $400 billion over the 10-year budget window. To fit within that constraint, many changes were made to the final legislation, including the use of delayed effect and phase-in provisions. Importantly, however, unlike most of the tax provisions passed in 2001 and 2003, the effect of the new Medicare prescription drug law was not sunset. Rather, it was enacted as a permanent change in the law. As it turns out, much controversy surrounded the CBO's $400 billion 10-year cost estimate of the final Medicare legislation. Shortly after enactment, for example, it was alleged that the Bush administration had withheld information from Congress that would have shown the estimated cost of the bill to be over $100 billion more than CBO's estimate. But the inaccuracy, if any, of the official cost estimate pales in significance to the real budgetary implications of this legislation. The true cost of the Medicare prescription drug benefit, meaning the present value of all future costs obligated by the program, has been estimated by the Medicare trustees to be $21.1 trillion. Thus, we see that the enactment of the Medicare law represented a huge new financial commitment by the government. The 10-year official cost of the legislation, with or without correction, represented less than 4% of the full budgetary consequence of the congressional action. Therefore, the budget process, which is intended to provide information to the Congress to make responsible choices about the nation's priorities, and to the public to be able to scrutinize those choices effectively, failed in the case of the Medicare legislation. Contrast the case of estate tax repeal. Because of its sunset prior to the end of the budget window, the true cost of this change is equivalent to the official cost, barring estimation error. Congress therefore acted with full knowledge of the law's budgetary implications and subjected itself to full scrutiny from the public for making its choice. Because estimating baselines take termination dates seriously, Congress will be confronted with additional costs should it decide to extend the Schedule 2010 repeal beyond that time. And assuming that any extension does not continue in effect beyond the budget window period at the time of the extension, Congress will again be presented with an official cost estimate equal to its true cost. Let me ask you to turn again to the handout, and I'll try to illustrate this last point by pointing to Table 2. What Table 2 has is four different ways in which the Medicare legislation could have been enacted. The first line represents the way, in fact, Congress did enact the Medicare legislation. And you see there that the official 10-year cost was estimated to be $400 billion in the second column in that table. The other three lines are hypothetical ways in which the Medicare legislation could have been enacted but was not. And I've just made these up, but all three of them are temporary forms of legislation. The second one is temporary with an expiration at the end of year 10. The third one is a temporary law with the expiration at the end of year 5. And the fourth is a combination of temporary law with other features, which reduces the cost down to $80 billion. Again, the one-fifth figure that we saw up above on line 5 on table 1. Now, as I've been trying to explain, the debate in Washington, for the most part, has been focusing on that official 10-year cost. And that's reflected both in the second column of Table 2 and the sum totals in Table 1. Opponents of the legislation have pointed to these various numbers and have said, if you have temporary legislation such as Line 3 or temporary legislation such as Line 4 of Table 2, what you're doing is you're misrepresenting the true cost in their minds being $400 billion. And so as a result of that, the debate has focused on, well, should we or should we not permit temporary legislation? Because, of course, having a sunset is one of the features that allows for this official 10-year cost to be reduced. My point is simply to say that all of these people, both the proponents and the opponents of the legislation, have missed the real point. The real point, it seems to me, is the far-hand column in Table 2, which is what I refer to as the unaccounted-for costs. And the basic point to say here is that when Congress enacted the Medicare legislation in 2003, no single member in Congress is on record as having approved a $21.1 trillion program. No single member of Congress has to go to his or her constituents and say, I voted for such an increase in federal spending. And yet that's precisely what they did. Yet, according to the record, if you will, they voted for a $400 billion bill because that's the official cost. The important thing to notice here, of course, is any of the temporary options, lines 2, 3, and 4 of Table 2, you notice that there's no unaccounted for cost. And that simply, of course, is the fact that the legislation expires before the end of the budget window period, so there are no additional unaccounted for costs that occur during that period of time. In short, an important threat to greater fiscal responsibility is the enactment of laws such as permanent legislation whose budget effect extends beyond the end of the budget window period. In that case, the official cost estimate of the legislation presented to Congress does not reflect the complete budgetary implications of the change in law. Congress, therefore, will be in a position of taking action without being able to make an accurate comparison from a budgetary standpoint of the cost of the choices before it. Moreover, the absence of complete information means that Congress can avoid being held accountable for its actions. In contrast, legislation whose budgetary effect expires no later than the end of the budget window does not present the same difficulty. Cost estimates of such legislation presented to Congress will reflect the complete budget impact, barring estimation error. Hence, at least from the perspective of facilitating responsible budget choices, temporary effect legislation should be encouraged, and permanent legislation should not be. Much more can be said about the budget consequences of temporary effect and permanent legislation, and maybe one of you will want to ask a question of me at the end of the talk. But let me, however, briefly turn to some of the non-budget related issues regarding this legislative choice. There are a number of other issues potentially implicated by this choice, and I confess that I have not worked all of them out in my mind. Thomas Jefferson, for example, favored temporary laws and even a temporary constitution as a way to prevent the dead hand of past generations from controlling the rules for current and future ones. On the other hand, as Madison pointed out to him, and as I alluded to initially, there might be chaos if most laws were adopted on a short-term basis and continually changed. One point worth remembering is that there need not be such a dramatic difference between permanent and temporary legislation. The history of permanent tax laws in this country, for example, is one of very frequent change. By one account, there have been over 15,000 changes to the law since the last major reform in 1986. At the same time, temporary effect legislation could be enacted in a way to achieve considerable stability and predictability if the Congress were to give priority to those attributes. For example, I have suggested that to enhance fiscal responsibility, there should be no budget effect of legislation beyond the end of the 10-year window period, the period the budget consequences of the legislation are taken into account in the legislative process. But there would be nothing to prevent a Congress within that constraint from extending an expiring law 10 years in advance of its scheduled expiration. By doing so, Congress could ensure stability and predictability of the laws for a 10-year period, a state of affairs that would compare favorably to our experiences with many permanent laws. Another concern about temporary legislation is its economic effect. Economists generally agree that tax incentives are most effective if they are adopted on a permanent basis. A temporary incentive simply increases the risk of an investment, and therefore the risk premium charged by the investor. In the worst-case scenario, one could envision investors disregarding completely the possible effect of an expiring tax benefit because of its uncertain application. In that case, should the tax benefit end up being continued and available to the investor, it would be a pure windfall to the investor and not provide any worthwhile incentive effect. Of course, many tax provisions are not incentives at all, but are intended to accomplish some other purpose, such as income support or redistribution. Other provisions are intended as short-term incentives, and for these, a temporary provision may be as effective or more effective than a permanent provision. Even if a provision is intended as a long-term incentive, passage of a temporary law may not be much different from enactment of a permanent law that is frequently changed. Investors learn from and take into account the frequency of tax law change in determining how risky a particular investment is. Indeed, it may be for this reason that the evidence has been very mixed on the effectiveness of past tax incentives. Finally, we should not forget one other important source of uncertainty for all investors, the concern that current fiscal policies are unsustainable. To the extent greater use of temporary effect legislation results in more responsible fiscal decision-making, the long-term budgetary situation should be improved with positive effects on the efficiency of incentives. Let me discuss one final issue, the effect greater use of temporary laws might have on the costs of influencing legislative outcomes, including amounts paid to lobbyists and campaign contributions and other benefits provided to legislators. In an application of the interest group theory of the legislative process, two professors have contended that the recent passage of temporary repeal of the estate tax resulted from an effort by the members of Congress to maximize the returns they would receive from the private sector. Key to their thesis was the passage of temporary legislation and the avoidance of possible permanent compromises in order to help string along the issue as long as possible. Thus, their study implies that the more temporary legislation that is passed, the greater the stringing along opportunities, and the more costs that will be incurred to influence legislative outcomes. This position is related to one other concern expressed by Madison to Jefferson, that necessary reconsideration of expiring legislation would engender pernicious factions that would otherwise not come into existence. In very general terms, the interest group theory of the legislative process conceptualizes legislation as carrying out a transfer of benefits from one group, typically thought to be large, disorganized, and with diffuse interests, such as taxpayers generally, to some other group, thought to be small, focused, and easily organized, such as persons or firms having some common special interest. Enactment of a tax provision benefiting only a small group and paid for by a slight increase in general tax rates would be a common example. Under this theory, the role of a legislator is somewhat analogous to that of a broker. Like a broker, a legislator is compensated for his actions in the form of campaign contributions and other benefits in an indirect way as a result of pairing up the two principals or groups and facilitating a transfer between them. Unlike a broker, however, the legislator actually creates the product or medium for carrying out the transfer by proposing and passing legislation. A legislator also does not merely serve as an intermediary between a willing buyer and a willing seller. Rather, the legislator forces the transfer upon an unwilling transferor for the benefit of a very willing transferee. The more legislative product generated by a legislator, the greater the potential return received, with the process being initiated by either the transferee beneficiary or the legislator himself. Now, suppose that under this model, a constitutional amendment were adopted barring the enactment of permanent legislation. The amendment might provide that the duration of all laws or an important subset of all laws, such as all tax legislation, could not extend beyond the budget window period. How would such a change affect the costs of influencing legislation? One consequence of the constitutional amendment would be a devaluing of the product potentially generated by legislators. The value of legislation is a function of many factors, but an important one is the duration of the law. It is for this reason that changes to the Constitution are generally viewed as having the greatest value, followed by permanent legislation and then temporary legislation. True, the long-term value of permanent legislation will be discounted to take into account the risk of subsequent amendment or repeal. Still, one would ordinarily expect permanent legislation to be more valuable than identical legislation that is scheduled to expire at some date certain. If the legislative product is less valuable, then the costs incurred to influence the shape and fate of that product should also be reduced. Under the interest group theory of the legislative process, the amount paid by a private sector group to favor or block a piece of legislation should be a function of the benefit or harm produced by the legislation to that group. If temporary legislation is less beneficial or harmful than permanent legislation, then the private sector payments should be less. There may be additional and possibly offsetting consequences to the constitutional amendment. Temporary legislation should be easier to pass than identical legislation that is permanent, perhaps because of its lower value. Thus, one supply-side effect of the constitutional amendment might be an increase in the amount of legislative product considered and passed by legislators, and this increased volume might offset, to some extent, the decrease in value of each legislative product. One constraint here, however, is legislative time. The amount private sector groups are willing to pay to influence legislative outcomes is presumably a function of the credibility of the legislative effort. And that credibility may in turn depend upon the amount of time spent explaining and debating the product, whether in hearings, other committee deliberations, congressional floor action, or meetings outside of the formal legislative process. Although one might expect temporary legislation to pass more quickly than identical permanent legislation, there would clearly be a limit to how much legislators could ratchet up their legislative activity to offset the devaluation of their product. Legislators might try to enhance the value of their product by changing some other dimension of legislation. For example, tax cuts might be made deeper or applied to a broader segment of people. But these possible changes, as well as the potential increase in the volume of legislation, would all be constrained by the budgetary consequences of the actions. As previously discussed, a switch to temporary effect legislation should reduce and possibly eliminate unaccounted for costs in the legislative process. This should mean that over time, under the hypothetical constitutional amendment, legislative choices should be more constrained by budgetary implications. Legislators, therefore, may not have much freedom to change the composition or amount of their legislative product. If the total amount of legislative product that could be generated by a legislature were fixed, then the constitutional amendment might have a favorable smoothing effect by ensuring that the fixed amount of production generates benefits over an extended period of time. For example, the passage of a temporary tax cut rather than a permanent one ensures greater private sector interest in the issue in the future when the legislature considers extending the temporary law. Thus, by approving a temporary rather than permanent law, the legislature could be viewed as passing up receipt of some private sector benefits in the current session in exchange for a continuing flow of such benefits in the future. This forced smoothing might turn out to be advantageous if, because of rules like campaign finance laws, there are limits placed on how much legislators can receive at one time from private sector groups. The problem with this argument, however, is that there is virtually no limit to the productive capacity of legislators within the overall constraints of legislative time and budget restrictions. Permanent changes to the law adopted in one session do not in any meaningful sense use up what a legislator can do in the next one. Different laws can be proposed and adopted, or existing laws can be modified or repealed, all on a permanent basis. Thus, there is no reason for a legislator to moderate his behavior in a given session, except for time and budget restrictions, since there is virtually no limit to the total amount of what he can produce. This is particularly true given the existence of short-term election cycles. A legislator who passes up the receipt of benefits in a current session in order to ensure a continuing flow in the future may not survive long enough in the legislature to realize those benefits. One final possible strategy of legislators to enhance the amount of private sector benefits might be to increase their use of incomplete contracts, that is, threatened but ultimately unexecuted legislative actions. For example, legislators might threaten to increase the taxes of certain persons, firms, or industries, and then eventually back off of their proposals in whole or in part. The recent flurry of proposals that I'm sure you're all aware of to increase the taxes of certain private equity and hedge fund managers, which has engendered a tremendous amount of lobbying and additional contributions to legislators, might be one illustration of this strategy. One advantage of the strategy is that depending upon what, if anything, is eventually enacted, there may be little or no budget impact to the legislative action, although legislative time, of course, will be used. Thus, legislators might successfully increase their use of incomplete contracts even in a world of severe budget constraints. And indeed, the constraint itself might help to make the threatened action more credible. But even if this strategy were employed, it is not clear why legislators would prefer to threaten temporary as opposed to permanent action if the latter presents a more harmful outcome to the interested groups, and therefore would generate a greater response from them in order to prevent the threatened action. In summary, under the interest group theory of the legislative process, greater use of temporary effect legislation should arguably reduce the costs incurred by the private sector to influence legislative outcomes. The reason is that the temporary nature of the legislation reduces the value of the legislative product and therefore the amounts private sector groups would be willing to pay. There may be collateral and possibly offsetting supply-side consequences to more temporary effect legislation, such as an increase in the amount, scope, and magnitude of legislation, but these effects may be constrained by legislative time and budget considerations. In my talk, I have disagreed with the conventional wisdom regarding the budgetary impact of temporary legislation. Specifically, I have argued that greater use of temporary legislation should enhance fiscal responsibility. Instead, it is the adoption of permanent legislation that is the real threat from a budgetary standpoint. I've also touched on a few non-budget related issues and suggested that although temporary legislation may not be clearly more favorable than permanent legislation from these perspectives, it is also not clearly less favorable. There are, of course, other policy issues that would need to be considered in addition to the ones I have mentioned. One final criticism I might anticipate is that the choice of temporary or permanent legislation only affects new laws adopted by Congress. Thus, any preference for temporary laws completely misses the real fiscal problem in this country, which is the budgetary impact of government programs already on the books that will soon provide benefits to the many baby boomers as they begin to retire. This is a fair criticism, and a temporary effect preference should best be thought of as merely a useful first step in addressing the fiscal problem. It bears remembering, however, that the current fiscal difficulties are the result of permanent legislation enacted in the past. There may have been understandable reasons for the design of that legislation, so that, as one analyst has stated, it is a tragedy without villains. But it is a tragedy nevertheless. And it is a tragedy that, just maybe, could have been avoided if the initial legislative efforts had not been allowed to have permanent effects. Some of you know that in Mexico recently, due to the controversial nature of the election they just had, the newly elected president of that country was allowed just 90 seconds to deliver the State of the Nation address before the national legislature. Now, that's less time than it took Dean Jeffries to introduce me, or the time it took to get to the first sex scene in the new HBO drama. This Mexican experience reminds all speakers that the success of any talk is very much dependent on the reception and generosity of the audience. Thank you all very much for your kind attention.